This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we have finished all chapters of Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, and we are doing our wrap-up episode. Last time, we ended Goblet of Fire with an odd number, so we attached the last chapter with the wrap-up. But now, it's a wrap-up all on its own this time.
Awesome. Yeah, for the brick. The 800 pages plus of this book.
857 or 67 at this point.
Good gracious.
Mm-hmm. So, you had a week or so to process the end of the book. Yeah. Overall, give me your review.
You know, this one, especially when I was like going through our questions that we're going to talk through, I felt like this definitely had more of a political element to it than other of the Harry Potter books. And because I was kind of trying to pick out some of the magical elements and had a more difficult time than I have in previous books. It wasn't as much fun, I don't think. Like, I mean, it's always a pleasure to read, but just kind of the lightness that was in some of the previous books and the whimsy is kind of fading. And I know I've seen kind of like the images of the, when I'm talking about the movies, the Warner Brother logo and how it kind of gets progressively darker in the Harry Potter movies. So this is definitely like, I feel like we're going down the tunnel and the light is kind of fading further and further. So I did not dislike it. There are some really excellent, strong characters in here that I will probably think of very often. I'll answer that question later. But yeah, how was the reread?
This reread, my opinions haven't changed too much. Again, it's always been my favorite book because of that political streak. And I feel like it's also a kind of step in a different direction in regards to the types of magic we see in the previous Harry Potter books, because up till this point, kind of this magic system is Harry Potter is treated very much like science. Like they have concrete subjects at school, and they have rules, and there are parameters and things like that. So it's very much a science. Whereas we've only gotten tidbits of it with Trelawney and divination, and again, not always portrayed necessarily in the best way. But with the Hall of Prophecies, with the sort of, you know, deeper implications of Lily's sacrifice and the legit blood magic that Petunia is binded with Harry and all that stuff, we're getting into some very deeply metaphysical forms of, like, more abstract, nuanced magic that isn't just very basic equations as it is portrayed in, like, all the Hogwarts subjects.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. We're growing up at this point. We're getting older.
We're growing up and the magic is getting way more complicated.
Much like life.
Much like life, indeed. So shall we go straight into the questions?
Sure. Yeah, the thing with reading these books, just to kind of, you know, fill some time here, I guess, it's always interesting, like, reading this over such a long span of time like we do, because mm-hmm. I feel like I do think about it. This is the kind of this is one of the reasons I'm one of the few people that, like, I don't mind not binging a show, because I always felt like if you have that week between, it kind of allows you to kind of develop some thoughts and things marinate. So I will binge a show. I will binge Stranger Things. No, I have not watched it yet. So everybody, don't give me any hell.
I only got to season two, end of season two. Haven't seen three.
I've seen them all except season four, because the other part drops on July 1st. So I'm just going to wait. But like, I'll probably binge that. But there are other shows. Like, I don't mind it going slow. So I just think it gives more time to think and analyze. So let us.
Yeah, that, which again, very true, because I binge read Song of Ice and Fire, so I'm glad that I'm taking it slow and more methodical with Nat and Podcaster's Landing. I binge read Hunger Games, so I know if we eventually get to that it'll be nice to slow it down and look at the real issues and allegories of war, voyeurism, and all those things.
Yeah, Hunger Games is interesting.
Yep. But, alrighty then. So, question number one. Well, I guess we kind of already discussed. How does this book compare to the others we've read thus far? I think we've covered that plenty.
Yeah, I think I mixed up our question. Oh, okay. Yeah. My copy-paste, I got a little overzealous. Oh, well, so then I'll say that now. I think this is in my top two. Not number one, but definitely my top two.
Ooh. Harry Potter so far. Nice. So, out of the 38 chapters we read, what was your favorite chapter and why?
So I flipped through real quick today. I feel like I have a tendency to always go for the ones at the end because it's the thing I'm most familiar with. But quite honestly, I really liked Dudley Demented. And I cannot believe I'm saying that, because usually when a Dursley's involved, I automatically hate it. But I liked how they brought some of the, you know, magical world and into the Harry's, you know, kind of little gap time between mm-hmm. Hogwarts excursions, and also to kind of like put the fear of God in Dudley, and also help the Dursleys realize, like, Harry's, you know, he has a crap life at home, and he's got like it's better at Hogwarts, but it's not exactly easy. So
yeah, and you know, Petunia, you know, Vernon, he's the one who married into this family, like, Petunia should know better in realizing that what happens in the magical world may have an impact on her own muggle world, but she just wants to pretend it doesn't exist. And it's a lot of development, because it's the first time with Dudley Demented, you know, when Harry says, oh, Voldemort's back, that Petunia legit understands what that could mean.
Yeah. I like that was my favorite. How about you?
Nice. Yeah, because you hated the catch-ups. You liked how it just started immediately.
I did. Yeah, I like that, because I feel like, yeah, and I think we've said this in the past, but if anybody just goes and is like, oh, that looks like a good book, five in a series, and I haven't read the others, then you don't deserve it. You should know what's going on by this point.
Yeah. So my favorite chapter was actually, I kind of went in the opposite direction at the very end, which is, I wouldn't say is very typical for me. Mine was The Only One He Ever Feared.
Remind me about that one. Let me look.
This is the badass battle between Dumbledore and Voldemort.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I respect
which,
that.
Which, again, it's typically not my style to go for such an action-packed chapter, because I am a huge fan of the slow burning mystery element of the Harry Potter books. So yeah, but just the action of seeing, because the closest thing we got to of seeing Dumbledore in action up until that point was at the end of Goblet of Fire, when Dumbledore storms in on Harry and fake Moody. And he restrains Moody, and you know, Harry sees that he's angry, but it's just like, you know, immediately like stuns the fake Moody or whatever. And like, that's it. And that's the closest we've ever really gotten to him being like mad and like fighting like the bad guys, shall we say.
Yeah.
Whereas this was the ultimate badass wizard fight of probably the two most powerful wizards within the latter half of the 20th century.
Yes, for sure. For sure.
At least in Europe, because the world is more than just Europe, and it's Eurocentricism.
Yes, that's, yeah.
So, yeah, that was mine. So, what was your least favorite chapter and why.
I hope I got this right. I think it was the OWL's chapter.
Oh, yeah.
Where it was all like them going through the testing. And I was kind of like, all right. Like, so I mean, things happened. We learned about the stress, but I would kind of like, I'm like, I don't need that flashback. Thank you very much. So, hopefully I got that chapter correct. It was the OWL's chapter. I probably didn't. I don't remember. But I scanned really quickly. I'm like, I think this is, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, which I've never, it seems you're attaching the same sort of, like with Quidditch. Like, I always appreciate seeing like the, you know, how like legitimately, if there was magic at this sort of school, how would they administer the test? Like what, like these actual nitty gritty details of logistics of how things would actually be run, which by the way, for as many teachers as they are, there's no way they could like have enough time to teach all the courses that they're technically supposed to.
Did we talk about this one time? You were like, this is just impossible schedule.
Yeah, we did talk about it once because I legit, in my nerdiness of trying to be as canon compliant as possible for some fan fiction I was writing, I was trying to figure this out and I'm like, this is just not feasible.
Oh, wow. Wow. So maybe all of them have the little time turner and we just don't know what.
Possibly.
So what was your least?
My least favorite chapter was The Beetle at Bay, which was the combination chapter of Harry's failed date with Cho and meeting Hermione and Rita Skeeter at the bar.
That's so funny because I thought about the failed date with Cho and I was like, I really wasn't super into that. So
again, I'm not saying it's like bad as in Cho is a bad character. Again, I think there's a lot in this whole book because it is a darker tone. There is a lot of just really sad things emblematic of old school Greek tragedy where people and circumstances are just such that like no one is bad or no one is trying to, you know, mess things up or deliberately do wrong, but just a comedy of errors comes together where bad shit happens. And with Harry and Cho, I've never in any of my rereadings have been one to demonize or belittle Cho, like her like demeanor at this point in her life is perfectly understandable, and you know she's not gonna accept when people just tell her to suck it up, but yeah. But and again, she's only a kid, but she should, again, both she and Harry are right and wrong in varying degrees. Like Cho should be smart enough to be like, yes, I deserve to grieve and everything and ask some questions about Cedric, but I shouldn't be trying to date Harry. That's not fair.
Yeah. Yeah.
And by extension, Harry should be like, I can't expect her to just completely forget about Cedric and say, oh, I'm the boy who lived. I'm so awesome. And be like all over me.
Right. Right. Do you think he had a little bit of that? I'm sorry. Ghost was making her presence known there for a second.
I don't necessarily. I think it was probably more just an afterthought of like, the one instance where I want the boy who lives celebrity or stuff to work to my advantage, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Because there's all this other heavy shit of Cedric's death.
Yeah.
So
keep him humble.
That was my least favorite. Not because it was badly written or that Cho is a bad character or anything like that. It's just, again, just that notion of great tragedy. That's just an unfortunate array of circumstances that make the situation suck.
Yeah. Yeah. Wasn't my favorite either.
Yeah. And again, I wasn't Rita Skeeter coming back.
Yeah, it was a clever title, like, for that chapter. Yeah,
well, it's just, because I really dislike Rita Skeeter because I hate, you know, to me, writing has such a positive quality and it's so creative because I write, I, like, you know, I'm a poet and things like that. So I hate the characters who, like, twist writing and make it evil, like, which is why I love that book Atonement because it talks about all those issues.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God.
That's, yeah, so, funny. Like, again, Rita Skeeter could have just been a novelist and she would have been a very successful one. She didn't have to be a journalist.
Yeah. You're just making me think about how heartbreaking Atonement is. So, thank you.
Oh, yeah. All righty then. So, within The Order of the Phoenix, who is your favorite character outside of the Golden Trio and why?
I feel like everybody knows this is going to be my answer. It's Luna Lovegood. And we talked a lot about Luna and how kind of she was kind of a split character. A lot of people like her. A lot of people think she's putting things on. But especially at the, I like her weirdness at this point in time. She reminds me of some people I know, and I appreciate their kind of quirkiness in that regard. And then how she handled the situation with Sirius dying at the end, and the emotional intelligence, like we talked about last time, I just think that made Luna really stand out in this book. She was my favorite.
Of course, she was my favorite too. How can you not? Because a lot of people have made the argument that possibly she is on the autism spectrum, and that she is a representation of neurodiversity, because that would attest to some of her rather, let's say, lack of social skills and just blurting out the truth and not really caring about the facade of politeness.
That's what I was going to say last time, where I said I thought something about Luna, but I didn't really know if I wanted to say it. It was that. And because I had just watched a movie called Cha-Cha Real Smooth, and one of the main characters is autistic. And she reminded me, and then we read those chapters about Luna, and I'm like, that's the same. It was the same traits. And I hope I said that correctly. I don't mean to. Autistic, yeah,
and
is correct,
you know, I appreciate Luna Lovegood. Again, she is the first, again, of all the kids who end up going to the Department of Mysteries to be on adventures with Harry, she's the only non-Gryffindor.
Right, she's Ravenclaw, I forget that.
Yeah, she's a Ravenclaw. So this is, with the exception of Cho, you know, which we didn't get that much of Cho in in last book. You know, it was limited, and it was limited here. So she's our first big secondary character that is non-Gryffindor.
Yeah, gosh, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, so it's, it shows an evolution of showing the other houses, which is always good. And I really like Luna because, well, first of all, I love her sense of fashion, even though I could never pull it off.
You can respect it. You don't have to, you know, that's somebody told me that one time. You can like it, but you don't have to imitate it or emulate it.
Emulate it. And then I like her interest in cryptozoology.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I feel like cryptozoology, obviously, depending on how far you take it, is a rather quote unquote harmless belief in something that hasn't been proven. But as I said before, I do, in the context of all this misinformation with COVID and stuff, and what right do people have to spread lies that affect public health. So from that, I am more scrutinizing of Luna in regards to some of her political conspiracy crap, which I don't think is, you know, because before I just dismissed it as quirky because it's like, oh, she can believe what she wants and it has no implications. But my opinion on that has substantially changed because now, again, with public health, people's opinions and actions don't just affect them.
Right, right. And just I agree with that. And because I think we've talked about, I like cryptozoology too. And that's kind of the whimsical conspiracy theory that I enjoy. I mean, yeah. I guess some people would say that's not whimsical. But I also don't know if maybe I should have said that Luna was neurodivergent. So if I spoke incorrectly, please forgive me. I am learning.
I'm just trying to think, what other good qualities are there, Luna? Well, we already, last episode, in her comforting of Harry, showing how she approaches things, and not in a cold way, but because she does it in a more impartial, less emotional way, Harry takes her more seriously about some of these really serious topics. And so, yeah. So we just need some of those people sometimes.
I agree 100% because that, you know, that would probably be more comforting. So I am, I'm just going to use Zodiac. I'm very Cancer. I'm very emotions. I'm very water. I cry, whatever. Mm-hmm. Where some people, when they need solace or comfort, like that's the last thing they want. They don't want somebody weeping on them. Somebody, you know, like some people I know in my life would much rather have kind of the more pragmatic approach to things like that. And then kind of keep other things behind the closed doors. And that shouldn't be criticized. It's just how some people work. Good on Luna. Props to Luna. She figured it out.
So Luna is awesome and she will continue to be a prominent secondary character.
Good. I like her.
Yep. Alrighty then. And so, moving on to who was your least favorite character outside the Golden Trio?
I mean, I'm going to let everybody guess. It's Dolores Umbridge. What a bitch. And now I'm just talking about within the story. As far as the way the character is written, or described by Harry, excellent. Like, excellent job. You hate this person. And I did not, she didn't redeem herself. Though I had a very, I had a conversation with my niece about who was worse, Dolores or Bellatrix. And I think she said Bellatrix. So I'm still undecided. I know Bellatrix.
I was wondering, because I was going to ask, because you had a very strong reaction to Bellatrix's, psychopathy. So I'm just like, is it going to be Umbridge or is it going to be Bellatrix?
I guess the only reason I didn't pick Bellatrix is because she is so unhinged. It's almost like, you run into those characters that are just so inherently bad. There's no redemption. And I feel like Dolores's meanness is more insidious. Like, it's political, it's physical. But she masks as somebody pleasant. And I guess as a person that I don't like to be lied to in any sort of capacity, like, I guess, hey, Bellatrix is crazy. She sucks. Great. Dolores presents as like, oh, I have teacups and I wear pink and I'm all great and whatever. And then she's just a heinous bitch. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I think we just don't get enough exposure to Bellatrix. Maybe if we got a little bit more, like, we get all close and personal with all the various forms of Umbridge's ominous cruelty.
Yeah. I mean, I might be eating my words in the next couple of books. So. Stay tuned.
Yeah, because, well, again, you brought up an excellent point. Bellatrix represents someone that is a legit psychopath. And so if you have a legit psychopath, most people's brain kind of basically turns off and it's been like, they're a psychopath. You can't do anything with them. Like,
yeah.
Which for a long time, I kind of, again, I'm not a psychologist in any way, shape, or form. I'm not set, with my husband, my husband's ex-girlfriend. I was like, again, not my place to say if she's a sociopath or a psychopath, but I was just like, okay, clearly has some mental issues that I cannot hold her accountable the way I would typically hold a woman accountable in their mid-30s.
Yeah.
So, but then when I realized that, oh, she is capable of responding like to potential consequences and certain behaviors stopped, that made me think, oh, and again, it wasn't always, oh, what a relief, she knows when to stop. It was more the insidious, okay, she knew how to stop. She just didn't want to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, again, with Dolores, it's far more insidious because, again, people work so hard to pathologize immoral behavior in their desperation to delegitimize it. And yeah. I'm just not like that. Someone can be totally sane and be totally immoral and horrible, and the fact that they're not like mentally ill, that doesn't take away the lack of legitimacy they have in their immoral behavior.
Yeah, I can think of 5 great examples at this moment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Interesting one. My least favorite character, I kind of went a different approach. Neither Umbridge nor Bellatrix. Cornelius Fudge.
Tell me about old Cornelius. Why did you not like him?
Yeah, so I was approaching it of Cornelius being, first of all, complicit in a whole lot of things. And he didn't want to accept that Voldemort was back and didn't want to accept that he was back, but was smart, but knew enough to know that Dumbledore's not just senile. If Dumbledore is saying this, he's got a bigger plan in mind. And so he convinces him, oh, he wants to take over the ministry. Cornelius Fudge, I think, represents the politician or executive directors to a lot of people in leadership, whether in politics or the private sector, who know how to, kiss ass and climb the ladder, but aren't actually competent leaders.
Yeah. Yeah.
To actually get shit done. And so I am blaming him for his, again, ineptitude, his being so insecure with himself, because it's said multiple times that in the early days of him becoming Minister of Magic, he was constantly writing to Dumbledore asking for advice. He's like, I don't know what to do. So in some ways, very much Dumbledore, it wasn't just that, oh, this is headmaster of a school. You know, in many ways, Dumbledore was kind of like a mentor to him.
And he just like took that knowledge and didn't do anything good with it. Like, what an idiot.
Yeah, didn't do anything good with it. And again, like so many certain politicians didn't want to risk alienating a constituency that wouldn't want to believe about a pandemic or deal with the restrictions, and so just ran with all the crap.
Yeah, only to like at the end of it kind of do an about face. I mean,
yeah,
you know.
Anyway, so yeah, I was very hard on Fudge for, again, being complicit and not doing anything, not being direct. Yeah, because you could, I think we're definitely in our society, at least in some sectors, are progressing to a point where we hold bystanders more accountable, because it's like, it's not enough to not be racist. You have to be anti-racist.
Right, right. Yeah, right.
So we're getting to a point in our culture where we are more scrutinizing of the bystanders and those who are complicit. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oof. Cornelius sucks, too. He just is a different kind of suck.
Mm-hmm. Him and his stupid bowler hat.
Yes. Screw that bowler hat.
Although the bad guy in what is it, So Cold the River, he has a bowler hat and he makes it sound badass, but not Fudge.
Well, yeah, I was gonna say, doesn't Watson from Sherlock, he wears a bowler hat, I think. I don't know. At least in the Jude Law one. You know, y'all know I prefer Benedict Cumberbatch, but anyway. yeah.
All right. And so, what was your favorite magical item that appeared in this book?
What I wrote, because I couldn't think of the name of it, was the sad mirror Sirius gave Harry.
Two-way mirror.
Yes, the two-way mirror. I'm like, it probably has a name that I just forgot given the week. Yeah, because it was very bittersweet. And I think that the point in Harry's life where he's like, I could have had more access. And I just love a just knife twist like that. As long as it's not in my life, if it's in a character's life, like, great.
As I was discussing earlier, I point to that as being the ultimate in like the tragic Greek irony that's used a lot in this book, because Harry didn't use it because it's like, I will not be the reason that, you know, Sirius get caught, when actuality, that was the safest way he could have had any communication with Sirius and not gotten in it, and just could have talked to Sirius in the comfort of his dormitory with the bed curtains closed. And yeah.
Yeah. I mean, essentially, I guess if I was thinking of it in modern times, it would be like having FaceTime without like what an encrypted FaceTime, basically. So it's cool. I don't know. I liked it. And I liked the moment in Harry's life where that happened. What was your favorite magical item?
It took me a while to figure this one out, but I went with the Archway of Death.
Amy, true to her gothic roots at this moment. Dang, yes.
Indeed, because it's interesting because I wasn't even thinking about it this way when I wrote that down, because it's just it's a badass, ruined, crumbling, super gothic archway. Yeah. And I feel like in some ways, I forget its exact description of the book, but I feel like it's supposed to be some sort of super ancient, like, Stonehenge thing. Whereas I tend to picture it, obviously, very gothic, architectural, crumbling, ruin, archway. But I think it's so common for us to use, like, the skeleton and the Grim Reaper figure as the anthropomorphical.
Yeah.
You know, symbol of death.
Yeah, yeah.
And not, again, portals are not, haven't not been used, certainly they have, but I felt like it was an interesting approach to, you know, how the wizarding world has this manifestation to death. And again, just the mystery, where the hell did this archway come from? where did England colonize that they took this from? And how did they know that it was death? And they took, and so they like, we need to take this.
Where the hell is this thing? Like, for real, for real. Like, I feel like maybe this is me and my like cryptozoology. You got to know some weird shit exists that we just don't know about. And I don't know if it's magic at this level.
Yeah. What is magic but undiscovered science?
There we go. Beautiful. Wonderfully said.
That's what, you know, my friend, you know, my buddy Lacey, she, you know, we had her on, you know, we had her on the show. She's a, she's a stark atheist. And so, but she went with me to the like little witches like block party where lots of like metaphysical vendors and shops were. So I got lots of cute stuff and I got some citrine and some honey calcite like stones. And she's like, I don't believe crystals do anything if they make you feel better. Sure. But I think it's just, you know, in your head. And I'm just like, well, I remember reading an article about, you know, scientists real, you know, starting to find like some of the energy stored in crystals and shit like that. But yeah.
Hey, I have many a crystals. I think I have some rose quartz in my and some black tourmaline, because y'all go get some black tourmaline if you're into that.
I was lacking yellowstones and I needed, so I got honey calcite and citrine because my yellow chakra is blocked at AF.
Oh yeah, well then there you go. Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect.
So anyway, so yeah, magical item, the archway. Because, yeah, the portal to death.
That's a good one. That's a good one.
All right. What was your favorite spell or enchantment within this book?
I feel like, hopefully I feel like this is a test and I'm going to get this wrong. But this is what I'm going to say. I liked the Occlumency, thank you, lessons. And I don't know if that qualifies as a spell, but it's kind
it's a type of magic. It's the spell is Occlumens, like legilimens.
Well, I didn't really feel like I had to pick it because I'm a yoga teacher and it's kind of like guided meditation in a way, but it was a pretty cool thing. And again, very, you know, you just kind of, I guess I really wish Harry would have mastered it or taken it more seriously, or Snape wouldn't have been such a little
bitch
ding dong. Yeah. Bitch. About it, and we could have progressed further in there. I still kind of agree with Dumbledore in that I don't know if he would have been the best person to teach Harry Occlumency, but like safety wise, that would have been a big risk. So it was cool. I hope it comes back up. Maybe Snape will get over himself. I don't know. I don't trust that guy. So that was my pick this time.
So my favorite spell, it does not have a name. I just had to, like, all I could think of was one of the spells that Dumbledore uses against Voldemort is where he just conjures a fire whip from the tip of his wand and it's just whoosh.
Badass.
Yeah, I want to be like fiery Indiana Jones.
Yeah. That'd be pretty cool. That's pretty mm-hmm. cool.
Alrighty. So what was your favorite magical creature that appeared in this book?
I've probably said this before, but that's fine. Fox. Because whenever he shows up, I know Kevin from Amanda and Kevin agree with me, but Fox is always super cool and, you know, kind of shows up at the right time. So, yeah. And I also couldn't really think of a lot of, again, this book was kind of very heavy on the political that I felt like there were fewer magical creatures. I did not like the grop or whatever. I was like, meh. And I don't know if he really qualifies as a magical creature. But
possibly. I think, again, because it's more political, it was less about introducing, oh, look, we have unicorns and this, blah, 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 blah. It was more about going deeper with, like, the centaurs. Like, deeper into things we already knew.
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, I thought about the centaurs as my favorite, but I like Fox, so I'm sticking with him. Ride or die.
Yeah, okay.
What about you?
My favorite were the Thestrals.
Oh, man, that's a good one. The spooky horses.
Spooky horses, super gothic. I'm surprised you didn't go with them.
I forgot about them.
you legit, even though they're the only way they got to the Minas, flew from Hogwarts, Scotland to London.
You know, yeah, no, I didn't, I forgot. I was really racking my brain, like, what freaking magical creature. I don't know. You know, I'm a sap. I like the Nifflers and stuff. So, but yeah, that's a good one and very important to this book.
Yeah, because they're dragging us skeletal horses. What's not to like?
That's true. That's pretty cool. I like it.
Yeah. Alrighty then. So let's see. In your opinion, what was the most gothic element in this book?
Okay. You talked about it already, but the veil, the kind of the archway that was stolen, the
I don't know if it was stolen. Maybe it was near Stonehenge.
They're British. They probably stole it and put it in a museum, right? That's what they did from India and stuff. I don't dislike British people, please. Good Lord. I was just trying to make a joke that John Oliver makes all the time. So, I mean, to me, that was so gothic. I mean, I have another gothic thought, but that really stood out as something very, I mean, Sirius dies because he goes through the veil. So it's like, I don't get more gothic than that. But what about you?
Mine was the wider umbrella of the Department of Mysteries.
Okay. Yeah.
Because basically the Department of Mysteries is just a very wizard version, gothic-esque Area 51, where, you know, all the things that we think they're up to in Area 51 is basically what they're doing in the Department of Mysteries. They're looking into, like, the most secret of shit. Like, it would not surprise me if, like, every time there is a new president, you know, they go in, you know, someone from the CIA or whatever debriefs the president. Okay, we actually are in contact with aliens. We actually do know about time travel. We actually do, you know, so all these things that the Department of Ministry goes into, you know, is researching time, death, love, again, possibly the cosmos with the astrolabe.
Do you think this, I got stuck on this thought. Do you think, like, if there is a Department of Mysteries like the US, do you think they just, like, didn't tell Trump about it? I mean, because I think that would probably be the best thing to do.
Honestly,
like, I couldn't trust
I think
him.
That I would like to think that they didn't tell him.
That's kind of what I think, because, you know, he'd be out there like, what did he say? White life. That wasn't him, but it was somebody at his campaign. And he was, and then, like, by the way, aliens are super real, everybody, and they're coming for us. So I don't know. I just don't trust that guy. Yeah.
Or
I don't
think they told him. Yeah. Because, and I don't even think it was that. I think the aliens saw Trump and it's just, and they just went to the, like, please don't tell this guy about us.
Yeah.
We'll wait for the next one.
Yeah. That's.
So anyway, so super gothic. Both in its physical ambience, it's at the absolute bottom of the Department of Mysteries. It's, you know, it's covered in black sconces with blue flames, and they're trying to figure out the most metaphysical shit of the universe.
Very goth. I like it. It's yeah. I was gonna say the Thestrals. Since I forgot and then remembered about them. Those are kind of gothic too. That was pretty cool.
Oh yeah. So, what was your absolute favorite quote from this book?
Well, y'all know it's gonna come from Dumbledore because it's me, so, you know, whatever. It was, indeed, your failure to understand that there are things much worse than death has always been your greatest weakness. So I think he says that to Voldemort, right?
Yes, he does. And yeah, I did read over that as I was picking my own quote. And it kind of shows. That quote shows the hubris of Voldemort as a villain, because even Sadist, like, realized that, oh, I'm not going to let you have a quick death. I'm going to, you know, slowly have you agonize in days. Or even Cersei Lannister in season 8 with the Septa, she slowly tortures her. Like, there are, you know, you may not think that there's anything after death, but death is just like sleep. You don't feel anything. You don't feel
right.
The deprivation of life.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's, I thought, you know, and I kind of, I appreciated it too, because I had never thought about Voldemort in that way, as far as, like, that's kind of what his fixation has been, because he kills Sirius, like, boom, it's done.
He didn't kill him. It was Bellatrix who killed him.
Oh, yeah. Or not Sirius. Oh, God dang it. I wasn't thinking Cedric.
Cedric.
The C name. Sorry. because Cedric just is gone, like, super quick. Not that I don't know if there was a lot of logic and thought behind that, but it was, you know, very devastating to everybody else around him. But, yeah, I don't know. So that was mine.
And it's just an interesting, you said, like, it's been your greatest weakness because in Voldemort's very immature mind, you know, magic should be above mortality. He never accepted that, oh, wizards may live a little longer, but wizards still die. And, you know, that was just his headcanon. And when people call him to the contrary, he's just like, nope.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it shows his ultimate understanding of magic itself is flawed.
Yeah.
In him thinking, you know, it's not even just underestimating the certain powers of, you know, love and other things, but it's also, this doesn't protect you from, again, this is like a science. There are parameters and he just wants to be all powerful because and he thinks that's what he deserves. And so that's what he's going to go with.
I stand by my quote. That was my favorite this go around. What was yours?
Mine was, youth cannot know how age thinks and feels, but old men are guilty if they forget what it was to be young.
Was that Dumbledore too?
Of course that's Dumbledore.
Okay.
You know Dumbledore is the most badass quote.
He really does. He really does.
Yeah, because ever since I watched that sort of like video essay about the Twilight Saga phenomenon and how, while there are, you know, legitimate arguments to be made against it, a lot of that is downright sexist and we want to condemn what young girls like. And so ever since then, I've always been more cognizant of how we shit on youth, but especially young girls, for liking what they like, from Twilight to Insta poetry to, which, by the way, the Insta poet Amanda Lovelace, I used to not like her because she's so simplistic, but because her poetry is so feminist, that's what I need right now. And so that's what I'm reading.
Yeah, I think that's excellent. And I love, that is my favorite. Like, if I were in college and I was in fem theory again, that's the thing I would have written papers about, like how teen girls are mocked for things that, you know, ultimately become like the Beatles or Elvis or Harry Styles. I mean, it's like, oh, dumb girls just like this stuff. It's like,
yeah, and things young boys like are equally dumb, but they're not hated, you know, vilified for it.
Right. And I mean, honestly, like the Beatles are, everybody's like, oh, best band in the world. And it's like, well, they would not have been anywhere if it weren't for the teenage girls that were interested in Elvis and all that stuff. I don't know. I really like to think about that. And I love, I liked that about Twilight too. It's like, just because women like it, it's immediately.
Or the fact that it so accurately depicts a young woman like dealing with a breakup. And
it really does.
It, you know, maybe it's not the funnest thing to read, but that is reality for a lot of, it certainly was me with my first like big breakup. I was a mess.
Me too. And I think that there were, and I got really frustrated with the conversation to the point where I just kind of abandoned some websites during that time that were making commentary on it, because it's like, everybody wants to think they're this like, you know, Joan of Arc feminist. And that's just not true. Like, some people do react to things like a breakup in the way Bella does. So I agree 100%. It's honest. And if you don't like it, then don't freaking read it.
Yeah, but yeah, old men are guilty if they forget what it was to be young. So yeah, because I think we so desperately want to put ourselves on the pedestal of superiority with age. And, you know, this happens even in, you know, Western culture, but it's especially true in, you know, more traditional hierarchical cultures where you just respect your elders, even if they're wrong, you just never talk back to them or challenge them in any way, shape, or form. And because of that strong hierarchy, there is no, you know, initially there's never any value given to the perspective of the young, even though, like in the Middle East, where these cultures remain prominent, the majority of the population is quite young.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So anyway, that was my quote. Then we can skip this question, I think. So you are started to rank them. Rank your favorite to least favorite books now, since we're dealing with a good five of them.
Oh gosh. Okay. So now I'm ranking them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Your favorite to least favorite.
Okay. Let me look at all the titles. I'm sorry. So I make sure I have it in order. It's only going to take me a second. No. Oh my gosh. Okay. Five. Prisoner of Azkaban is number one. This is number two. Order of the Phoenix. Goblet of Fire, three. Chamber of Secrets, Philosopher's Stone. That's mine.
Nice. One moment. My fancy Bluetooth headphones ran out of juice to go back to normal headphones.
That's all right.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, so what were we talking about? Sorry.
Oh, no, we ranking. Were talking about... Ranking. Yes, yeah. Yes,
ranking. Okay. So my rankings are literally Order of the Phoenix, number one. Number two, okay. Goblet of Fire. Okay. Number three, Prisoner of Azkaban.
Okay.
Number four, Chamber of Secrets. And number two, Philosopher's Stone.
Poor Philosopher's Stone. And that's like the intro one, right? That's like what gets you... hooked.
Yeah, well, honestly, again, most people dislike Chamber of Secrets much more than Philosopher's Stone, but that's not me. And so, like, yeah, as they stand right now, they're literally in order. Once we get into the other books, then it'll get mixed around a lot more. But yeah, that's where it stands of these five books.
Okay, I was going to say, I know mine will change. And yeah, for sure.
Okay. So I did bring out.
Hello?
No, my husband just dumped one of the cats in here to make sure they don't fight.
Aw.
Yeah, and he, again, this is one of the ones he gave her a shave for the summer, for her Aww. Summer coat, because she's fluffy and now she looks really weird.
Aw, poor kitty.
Disheveled. No, poor kitty. It'll grow back. But I did have a few questions.
Yeah.
Let's see. Extra questions for Order of the Phoenix. Here they are. So how did this book make you think about the dilemma of what a child/teenager can handle?
I think that's a good question. And Harry deals with some heavy things, but I think it's naive to think that like all 14, 15-year-olds don't deal with heavy things. I mean, like, look at the world we live in. We got a lot of heavy things going on. Poverty. I know my mom is a teacher in a kind of rural area of the country, and just kind of some of the things that she sees kids deal with are not things that, like, I guess as a person, a white woman who grew up in a middle-class family, didn't have to think about. So I think we could kind of like parallel that a little bit with Harry, in some of the heavy stuff that he has to deal with. I think it's portrayed well. I think as much as Caps Lock Harry was a little intense, like being a teenager, you know, I look back at my teenage self and I'm like, oh my God, like chill. But there's a lot of things at play, you know, things are new, hormones, emotions, and you're coming out of that child, you know, you're kind of discovering what you like, or your friends like. So did it make me think about it? Yeah. And I think sometimes I'm always like, oh my God, I can't believe they're having to deal with this. But when you really step back and think about it, it's just a heightened magical level of problems. You know, it's not moms, you know, shooting up heroin in the kitchen. It's like, you know, Voldemort's after me. So.
Yeah. So interesting, because yeah, should have put this as my favorite again. One of my favorite chapters again is of Order of Phoenix is again the argument between Molly Weasley and Sirius Black, because they each represent the opposing views of how much Harry should know. And it's just not just in Harry's case, but in all cases, I feel like, you know, it's really hard because it's like, obviously to treat everyone fairly, you know, you have to have a legal benchmark, okay, of what is an adult. And they're like, just administratively, that's just what you have to do. But in reality, I know that, you know, there is what one 15-year-old's maturity at is not necessarily what another 15-year-old's maturity is at.
Right.
So, and you have to analyze case by case. It's like, do they really know what they're doing? And again, in those questions of, you know, okay, he's just really immature. He doesn't understand what's going on. Or the other ones where it's just like, no, try him as an adult. He knew exactly what he was doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then also, you know, kind of getting a little off a tangent here, but I was listening to some documentaries about, you know, sex offenders after they complete their sentences. And a lot of them, you know, the flaw in the sex offender registry is that it ranges everything from the most horrible, you know, kidnapping and raping children to the 19-year-old who did not know that the girl was like 2 years younger than him, 17 right. rather than 18 years old. So like, yeah. So the fact that he gets put with the same, you know, label as like the lowest scum of the earth.
Right. Right.
So yeah. So just how we approach dealing with the level of culpability and responsibility that, you know, teenagers can handle, you know, it's a hard one. And I think, again, if we're not being bound by legality, which in Harry's case, in Dumbledore's case, they're not, you know, yeah. that was just Dumbledore's, you know, discretion and decision, where, you know, Harry's already been through so much. He's in case by case that they should be able to say, okay, Harry's unfortunately never had a decent childhood. He's had all this crap happen to him. The best we can do is prepare him.
Yeah.
Because again, that innocent childhood, that ship set sail.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Long ago.
For a long time ago. So yeah. So that's just always one of the sort of issues I think about in regards to Order of the Phoenix is, you know, how much can a child handle? What should they be allowed to handle, even if they can technically, and all those things? And what are the external consequences if you don't let them handle it?
Right. Yeah.
Because, like, literally, I think, I forget which psychologist I heard say it on TV, but basically, you know, there can some instances, if you make a child be an adult, then they're going to be a child, then they're going to become a child when they're an adult. Like, it's just going to mess them up.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's my husband and I talk about that. Like, some of our friends that maybe didn't, like, leave home to go to, well, I mean, and I say this, I left home, came back to go to school, that, like, you know, they kind of party a little harder in later in life. And we're kind of like, we got that out of our system when we were younger. So mm-hmm. I kind of think that that's kind of what an example of.
Yeah. Delayed of adolescence.
Yeah. Ugh.
Anyway, so
I'm an old lady at this point. I've been an old lady my whole life. So anyway,
again, I got it out of my system and I still got good grades, and now I can enjoy my Friday, Saturday nights in my 30s, drinking blueberry and blackberry wine, reading 19th and 18th century poetry.
See, there you go. See, you don't have
while
to.
While I hand feed grapes to my raccoons.
Delightful. Which, like, I'm
which Snow she White. We saw the babies for the first time this year. Aww. The fourth generation.
Aww.
Two cute babies, and they're so cute.
I think raccoon babies are adorable.
Yeah. Those are my thoughts with that question. And then I had another question, which very loaded, and, you know, we can go as long or short as you want. What political things in this book are most relevant to today?
Well, I'm not fully ready for that quiz, so I might need a minute to think.
Okay, I'll start with mine.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, obviously, you know, I'm not sure exactly when this episode is going to air, because I am going to switch up the scheduling and only upload episodes every other week, because life and adulting. But at the time of this recording, it is a Monday, and the previous Friday is when Roe versus Wade was overturned. And everyone is still in shock that, you know, the Supreme Court has never done such a thing in terms of basically completely dismissed a near half century's worth of precedent for something so monumental that's going to affect so many people. And that very much reminds me of all these stupid educational decrees that Dolores Umbridge was. Because again, it's not even like, oh, we got Trump, but we, you know, obviously dismissing the Electoral College and that crap, like, you know, technically we can say, well, you guys voted for him, or you didn't vote, so you didn't get enough counter votes. But the Supreme Court justices, no one voted for them. You know, Trump, right. You know, Trump appointed them. And so, yeah, so it's a situation of this person who, these people who are just given free reign, just the way Dolores is being given free reign to just declare whatever she fucking wants. And as we were discussing off mic, the language involved in, like, this declaration of overturning Roe versus Wade was not, did not include their traditional, like, very professional, like, stoic, trying to explain the reasoning and be gentle with the opposing view. It was just very aggressive and abrasive, you know, the subtext basically being, you know, we have the power, you don't, screw you.
Yeah, you know, since you brought up, so the thing with the, if we're gonna talking about, like, Dolores and her kind of
tyranny.
Yeah, her tyranny. And then the Supreme Court justices, I think the difference about, the difference between Dolores and then, let's say, Justice Kavanaugh. Like, we know kind of where his ideology is derived from, you know, like, we can learn, like, we can follow his career. And I just wondered if that's ever kind of, if we ever get into, like, the background of Dolores, like, where did that come from? You know, we know Amy Coney Barrett, it doesn't matter if I say her name right or wrong. She's an idiot. Yeah. like, it has never been a secret that she is, you know, wanted to dismantle Roe v. Wade, or, you know, was anti-Roe, even though she may have said something else on the stand, which is very interesting. But for, like, Dolores Umbridge in this case, do we know where her ideology is rooted? Do we know, like, or is it just like, I'm a pure blood, so screw
everybody? I don't mind telling this to you, spoiling this, because it is not in the books. This is just extra stuff I've read because I'm a nerd. You know, her background is such that she is a half-blood, and so, like Gilderoy Lockhart, where she grew up as a witch with Muggle siblings, and so it gave her this inflated sense of superiority. And so she got, so okay, that sort of sense of superiority and pure bloodness, and that extending to her, you know, dislike of half-breeds and stuff, that comes from the very personal, like, family dynamic of, because with Gilderoy Lockhart, it's the same thing, but it sort of manifested itself in a very personal, narcissistic way, whereas Umbridge, it channeled in the very insidious political way.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, you know, kind of like what you said, it has such implications, the decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. And I've, you know, my background is in women's and gender studies. So this is something I was in college that we talked about, like, just the decision and then, you know, whatever. And then when Trump was elected president, we all kind of went, oh gosh, it could happen. That's why we were freaking out. One of the many reasons we were freaking out. Yeah, so I kind of haven't fully, I don't think, comprehended the implications. And I don't know if we will fully kind of understand the implications of the overturning Roe v. Wade.
Until women start dying.
Exactly.
In emergency rooms.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's going to happen. And just other implications. Because something that I'm really concerned about, and I don't know if I can apply this to Harry Potter at the moment or not. I guess I could. Is, like, the lack of the objectification of women. Not that we aren't objectified already, but kind of like the okay to objectify women further. It's like, you're not, you know, you're not a full person. You're something that you're there to produce babies and workforce and whatever. And just, I guess, if I'm kind of, you know, we could talk about the house elves. I don't know. I'm really reaching for an analogy in Harry Potter, but yeah, I don't know.
Well, just Umbridge's contempt for half-breeds, any half-breeds, be they house elves, be they for Hagrid being a half-giant, for the centaurs, for anyone. She's just like, you don't deserve the same rights as me. And a lot of old men and Uncle Toms think that, you know, Clarence Thomas.
Oh, okay.
The Uncle Tom.
Okay. I didn't know that's what they called him. Okay.
Well, isn't that the sort of generic term for the black guy who is kind of sort of sold out?
Oh, I was going to say, I'm going to look it up because I, A black man considered to be excessively obedient to or servile to white people. Yeah. Okay. There we go. I learned something new. Very yeah. interesting. Yeah.
So yeah, in terms of, again, Harry Potter is political in a lot of ways in terms of, you know, some maybe people on the other side, like with anti-vaxxers, would take away from the Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix that see, like, Harry Potter shows that the government can't always be trusted, therefore we shouldn't be taking these vaccines. We should be questioning what we read in the newspaper and reliable sources. Like, who's to say that this is true and my podcast or my stupid news feed has more reliable information. So like there's tons of all that stuff, but that's kind of what I've honed in on more. And then the smear campaign aspect is my personal experience. I've honed in on that more, but this was my first time really thinking about just these declarations that Dolores can just make without any input from anyone else, and that she's just given full rein. And now the same has occurred with the Supreme Court.
Yeah, she's the embodiment of that. And,
yeah.
And it has real-world implications. I think that's the thing that these people forget. Like, this is going to affect people. I mean, sure, maybe they think about it, but it's like, it doesn't affect... What did I see? Some, like, little cross-stitch that said, your congressman's mistress can still get an abortion. Like, I thought, that's an interesting thought.
Yeah, that's the thing, that like all these people, not just politicians, but all like middle class evangelical, white people, like they'll still be able to secretly have the means to surreptitiously get like their daughter's abortions taken care of and whatever, so they don't create scandal. But,
Right.
Anyway, so.
Dark day in American history.
Dark day. And those were the extent of my extra questions for Order of the Phoenix. Did you have any other thoughts?
Dark time in Harry Potter's life. No. No. I always enjoy it. I always enjoy going further down the Harry Potter rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to those deaths that I know about. And I know they're coming. So.
Oh, yeah. Alrighty then. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. And tune in next time where we will begin Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince with chapters 1 and 2, which I don't have the book in front of me. So the chapters are called The Other Minister and Spinner's End.
Wow.
Yeah. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophia Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophia Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophiaMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophia Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophiaMareStudios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks.
That was the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.